It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we get the latest on the actors and writers strikes in Hollywood with an LA Times reporter, then some analysis from a Wisconsin expert on labor. First, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse was released in theaters last month to critical acclaim and success at the box office. It featured a unique mixture of 2D and 3D elements. It's a departure from the Disney Pixar style we've seen dominate animation over the last two decades. More blockbuster movies like Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, and the upcoming Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie are following a similar path. How does this new style build on animation of the past? How have artists innovated the medium up until now? Our next guest is a Wisconsin expert on animation history, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite animated movie or TV show? What makes it special or memorable? What animated movie or movie with animation elements blew your mind when it first came out? Is there a style you prefer? Do you like to watch animation from outside the U.S., like, say, Japanese animation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is an associate professor and director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee. Jocelyn, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob. I always love to be on.
Good to have you back. Now, we've had animation pretty much for as long as we've had movies, right?
That's definitely true. As a matter of fact, it's kind of hard to separate animation from live action. They're both sort of based on the same principle, right? Which is that there's 24 frames per second. With animation, those frames are just drawn or sometimes, you know, performed by stop motion. But yeah, basically since the beginning of film, we have the emergence of animation as a form as early as the very, very early years of the 20th century.
What were a couple, give us a taste of the couple of earliest types of animation we saw?
Sure. There's two that we generally point to as kind of like hallmarks of sort of first film, first animated films. It's always a bit like difficult to say with certainty what is the first. But generally speaking, historians agree that John Stuart Blackton's The Humorous Phases of Funny Faces from 1906 is the first animated film. When you see it, you can look it up on YouTube. It's pretty widely available. When you see it, it'll look almost like it's hand-drawn, but it's actually done with cutouts. So that's the first kind of animated film. But then Emile Cole's Fantasmagorie from 1908, which is really delightful, kind of like surrealist metamorphosis little film. That's really the first drawn animation, the first cartoon that we think of. And that is in 1908.
All right. One name tends to dominate, I think, what we think of when we think of animation. And one movie really set the stage for traditionally animated feature films. Here's a taste.
I hope, I hope, I hope, I hope.
It's Snow White. It's Disney. Can you talk about this as a milestone for better and for worse?
We cannot talk about animation without talking about Disney. And there's a way that I want us to kind of think about him today. And that's not necessarily as an artistic innovator, but as an absolutely incredible businessman. If I were to, you know, to categorize Walt Disney as one thing, it would be shrewd businessman, because he was very, very good at hiring the right people and occasionally getting people to, well, maybe kind of steal other people's work. So if we're thinking about something like Snow White, there's several really incredible technological developments that are present in that film. The first one is the multi-plane camera. And this is one of the most important developments for animation in general, especially if we're thinking about eventual transition over to digital animation and to 3D environments. The way that the multi-plane camera worked is that it was about a 15, 20 foot tall structure, this really tall structure, and it had multiple panes of glass, right, stacked on top of each other with a little bit of space in between. And each glass pane had a different piece of artwork that would constitute one of the different layers of an environment. And then the top pane, you could have the cell animation of the character moving. The camera would then shoot through the top of the top pane through all of these different layers. And that gives this really wonderful feeling of three-dimensionality in what is actually a 2D work. So the next time you look at Snow White, especially these sequences in the forest, you should notice how the layers kind of seem to move, and you get this kind of uncanny illusion of moving through deep space. That's achieved with the multiplane camera. And the funny thing about the multiplane camera is that even though William Garrity patents this in 1937 under the aegis of Walt Disney, something very, very similar was actually made in the 1920s by a German animator named Lottie Renninger. She made this really famous feature called The Adventures of Prince Ahmed in 1926. And she developed this this object called the Tricktisch, or the trick table. And that was an early iteration of the multiplane camera. But the thing is, she never patented it. So Walt Disney was able to take that one over.
Now, I want to talk about the labor that goes into something like a Disney-style feature film or the other people who imitated or were inspired by it. Could you just talk about the labor and who was doing all this work?
Yeah, when we think about animation, we should always be thinking about labor. We think about a movie set in general, and like there's so many people involved. It's easy to say like, oh, there's the set designer, you know, there's the cinematographer, there's the best boy and the gaffer. But there's just as many people working in an animated film. It's just that their labor is invisible because we don't end up really seeing them on screen, and we only see the eventual art that results from their work. Early on in animation, early animated films, they're primarily made by one person, right? Like one artist does everything from the writing to the designing to the drawing, everything. But that's really inefficient. That takes a lot of time. It's super, super labor intensive. So once animation becomes something that's picked up by bigger studios, the studios start thinking, well, we could actually make this a much more efficient practice. So in the 1910s, cell animation is developed, and that's where you have the cell of the character animation on top of an already animated background environment, so you don't have to redo that background every time. But the other thing that's determined by studios, as well as people like Winsor McCay, who are working on animation and creating these great innovations at this time, they realize that what we can do is we can do something called in-betweening using keyframes. And a keyframe is going to be like the major movements of a character. So think of a character like jumping in the air and landing. The keyframes could be the character preparing to jump, the top of the jump, and then the bottom of the jump. But in between, there's a whole array of like very minuscule, tiny movements that the character is making. So you can have your head animator do those keyframes, right? And establish those big movements that require a lot more expertise and a lot more artistry. And then you can have other folks come in and do the what is called the in-betweening. And those were positions, the in-betweeners or the colorists or like the line colorists. Those are positions usually taken on by people who might be apprentices, who might be learning the trade, and actually often by women. So these are really, you know, really important roles, but they're performed by people who are generally like below the line folks. As we move forward in the history of animation, that kind of labor becomes a real sticking point, right? How do people get paid for the work that they're doing, the really important work that they're doing? That's why in 1941, we see the Walt Disney animation strike, which was a really big thing that rocked the industry and important to think about today when we're actually going through the SAG-AFTRA strike as well.
Looking at the history of animation with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies from UW-Milwaukee, let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Delavan. Chris, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I just wanted to make a comment that you know, the animation style that Across the Spider-Verse did and its predecessor, I thought was really positive to the industry. And that's one of the main reasons why people really love it. And, you know, especially since, you know, anime is becoming so popular and mainstream nowadays. And what's really funny, you know, because we brought up Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and how this next movie that's coming out is going to be kind of following that same animation style. I was talking to my fiance the other week, and I said, wouldn't it be great if Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles would do something like this? Because I feel like that's what they need, because all this realistic, you know, animation that they've been doing the last, you know, 20 years, I don't think works for them. It's a little creepy, and I just think that would be great. And then lo and behold, I saw an article, and that's, sure enough, that's what they're doing. And I think
wonderful. Thanks a lot for the call, Chris. And Jocelyn, Chris gives us a lot there. We've had this Disney Pixar, well, Pixar, then bought by Disney style, the 3D animation, and these reactions to it now with the Spider-Man movie, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie on the way.
Totally. I mean, I think like the obsession with this particular version of digital realism is so annoying. It's so reductive, right? It doesn't leave space for some of the wonderful things that animation can do. Animation is a mode of like boundless possibility, right? It's the space where absolutely anything can happen. And I think we've gotten really stuck in this mode of mimicking reality as opposed to embracing the wonderful stylization, the wonderful artistry, all these like absolutely incredible possibilities that have always been latent in animation. So if you watch something like Fleischer Brothers cartoons from the early 1930s, the Fleischer Brothers are some of my favorite animators, just like really amazing. If you watch them now, they will seem like completely bizarre, completely weird, because it was a moment of total experimentation. So I think with this obsession with being really, in some ways, you know, quote unquote, true to real life, we've forgotten about all of the boundless possibilities that animation actually grants us. So I agree. I'm just really excited to see a new level of artistry brought back into animation.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor and Director of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee, looking at animation and how it's changed over more than a century now. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite animated movie or TV show? How have you seen animation change over maybe your lifestyle? Is there a favorite style, a favorite producer, director of animation? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor and Director of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. We're looking at the history of animation from the dawn of moving pictures through the Spider-Man multiverse and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an all-time favorite animated TV show or movie? What do you see as really groundbreaking? Do you have a favorite style, old school or newfangled? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, you got a favorite?
I do, yeah. Thanks, Rob. Ever since I was a kid, I've always liked Donald Duck. And the reason is he has emotions. And when I was a kid, I always watched him express his emotions. And he always came to a point of laughter. So years later, I was on a cruise and I bought a lithograph of Donald Duck laughing. And in my apartment, I put the lithograph as the last thing I would see when I left my apartment. And he always made my day, because his laughter and his smile, I mean, the emotions were real to me and pointed the right direction of how I wanted to feel. And it was more than just entertainment to me. It was really kind of a psychological affection I had for him.
Interesting, Jeff. Thanks a lot for that. And Jocelyn, Jeff points toward the connection we could feel with these clearly non-real characters, from, you know, a Donald Duck through maybe a Pixar character or beyond.
Absolutely. And, you know, Jeff is like actually absolutely right. He has this feeling, but what he's also noticing is something that was deliberately put in there by Disney. Disney animators were trained in the 1930s in a form of animating action that is extremely expressive. So they were actually trained by folks who came from the acting world as to how to integrate movements that specifically spoke to emotional expression. That was something that Disney animators deliberately developed over time, and it was particularly studied right when Snow White was being made. And Snow White's also made with the use of the rotoscope, a really important animation technology where an actor is shot live action, and then the animator traces on top of that actor. So that translates to a real fluidity of movement. It actually is kind of like an uncanny movement a little bit, but it's very fluid, very naturalistic. And then the animators would later use that footage to study movement and then to integrate that kind of expressive movement into characters, specifically to create an emotional connection with the audience.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jeff. I want to back up. We talked about kind of the post-Pixar era. I want to talk about the movie that kicked off Pixar being the thing.
You're my favorite deputy.
You've got a friend in me.
And here, Jocelyn, a lot of people had a friend in Buzz Lightyear and the others in Toy Story. Now we're so used to the style. How big a deal was it when Toy Story came out?
It was such a huge deal. Sorry, there's
an air show going on behind you, I understand. Yeah.
Yeah, the air show is happening back there. It was such a massive deal. So Toy Story comes out in 95, and there's already a lot of experimentation with digital animation at that point, but Toy Story is the first fully digitally animated feature. So it was just like a massive deal. If we look back at it now, it's actually kind of creepy. Like, the characters don't blink. It's very creepy if you look at it now. But it really was massively groundbreaking. And Pixar itself has just been such a juggernaut in terms of animation. Once Disney finally acquires Pixar in 2006, well, they had tried to do it for quite a long time, but they finally do acquire them in 2006. And that really leads to Disney being like such a massive global multimedia conglomerate that really directs how we understand childhood to a great extent.
Let's go back to our callers. Jack is with us now in Madison. Jack, hi.
Hi, Rob. Hey, so I heard your guest talking about Toy Story just a moment ago, and I should say that I was born the year it came out, incidentally, so I've always had a thing for CGI, but I guess to combine that with, you know, talk about Snow White and the other old animated pics got me thinking about a game that came out a couple years ago called Cuphead. Mm-hmm. You might have heard of it, and I think it's really cool the way those game devs were able to fuse a lot of the digital and CGI tech that we have today with nostalgia for old animation. And I know, just it's cool thinking about how and when the older mediums meet the newer ones and what implications those have for future games and movies.
Jack, a great point. And not just Cuphead, but I think a lot of video games play with different animation styles. And I've read, at least, Jocelyn, that the Spider-Verse movies are then looking to video games as inspiration as well. There's this conversation going on.
Oh my gosh, you can't see me clapping, but I am like so excited that Cuphead was brought up. Let me be frank, Rob. I can't play video games like Mario jumps, he falls in the hole. Mario jumps, like that's my video games experience. But I have a special love in my heart for Cuphead because it's based on Max and Dave Fleischer's cartoons from the early 1930s. They were famous for a style that we call rubber animation. And that's where, you know, you'll see in Cuphead that like the characters kind of like stretch and shrink and they bounce off things. And they have this very kind of like bouncy, springy kind of a way to them. That is directly inspired by the Fleischers. And the Fleischers worked a lot with urban life. They were New York animators. They were Jewish. They were around a lot of immigrant communities. They went to the Cotton Club and they loved Cab Calloway. So there was a lot about like the urban multi-ethnic depression experience in their films. And then we see that in Cuphead now. It looks so uncanny to us because it's actually from an earlier moment in history. And history is something that gets very deeply uncanny for all of us. But video games in general, so important for animation. I think about something like Final Fantasy from 2001, which was a massive box office failure, but was actually directed by the creator of the game. So that's like an early moment where we see this transition from video games into animated feature and vice versa. They're kind of always playing into each other in multiple ways.
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. Jocelyn, I don't want to get out of this conversation about animation without a visit to Japan. Anime, the catch-all term for a huge variety of animation coming out of Japan. What are some of the distinctive styles we see in animation from Japan?
Yeah, there's so many that to point to, but I think we think a lot about something like Astro Boy, right? Like from the 1960s, which actually, it's really, really funny, is based in part on the Walt Disney style. So that's actually based on something like Bambi, the really big eyes. So a lot of like what we think of as originating from Japanese animation also is inspired by cultural product from the United States. So those really big eyes, especially from these earlier moments of Japanese animation, are in large part inspired by Disney characters. One of the things that's really important for Japanese animation too is the usage of limited animation. And, you know, I should try to like keep this as short as possible, but limited animation is essentially animating fewer than 12 frames per second. And that gives it that kind of stilled quality, right? Like where a character might be screaming and they're frozen. That's very, very much a hallmark of Japanese animation. But also just really elaborate environments, right? Like really fast movement, fast kind of camera movement as opposed to character movement. Japanese animation is a really, really rich, incredible legacy of powerful artistry and really, really big ideas.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Jocelyn, is there something you are excited about on the horizons of animation?
Well, my favorite contemporary story is, or contemporary studio, pardon me, is Laika Studios, who are responsible for Coraline, for Paranorman, for Kubo and the Two Strings. I'm looking forward to their newest film because they integrate wonderful artistry, beautiful stop motion animation that's very detailed and very stylized with some usage of digital smoothing. So you still have that wonderful feel of the hand of the artist that's combined with the forefront of digital technologies. And I love that they use so many human beings to make what they make. Right now, especially, it's so essential for us to remember that art is created by human beings and not by machines.
Jocelyn, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
It's so wonderful to be on. It's great to talk to you, Rob.
That's Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor and Director of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. She talked to us about the history of animation and how the techniques of the past influence the animated movies and TV shows of today. Hey, there is still time for you to share your favorite animated movies and TV shows, or maybe a character from the world of animation from anywhere in the world. Tell us about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. If I get a couple few responses on that, I'll share them maybe tomorrow or next week. Coming up after the news, we'll check out the big labor actions in the entertainment industry and what it could all mean for film and TV the rest of this year and beyond if the actors and writers' strikes continue. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, businesses are seeing backlash when they get involved in social issues, and that's nothing new. A historian shares the story of protests against businesses who embraced civil rights progress in previous generations. Now, Hollywood actors under the union banner of SAG-AFTRA are on strike starting this week. They joined writers who began a strike more than 2 months ago. The two major entertainment creators' groups haven't been on strike at the same time since 1960. Basic pay, money from streaming services, and the threat of AI replacing human talent are some of the roots of the disagreement. And while it seemed like SAG-AFTRA negotiators and the studios may have been poised to strike a deal, there wasn't enough major structural change for the actors to accept it. Here's SAG-AFTRA president and actress Fran Drescher talking about the gravity of the strike authorization and the disruption of the entertainment industry.
You cannot change the business model as much as it has changed and not expect the contract to change too. We're not going to keep doing incremental changes on a contract that no longer honors what is happening right now with this business model that was foisted upon us. What are we doing? Moving around furniture on the Titanic? It's crazy.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the actors' strike and the ongoing writers' strike? What stands out to you? Do you have questions about it? Have you worked in that industry? What's your perspective? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Meg James is a senior entertainment industry writer for the Los Angeles Times. I talked to her earlier today. It looked earlier in the negotiations, just a few weeks before the actors' strike started, like things were going pretty smoothly. What broke down?
Yes, this is an interesting development that we had been monitoring. The actors came in really strong. They had a strike authorization vote before they started their negotiations in early June. But things just started, like, it looked like they were making progress early on, both sides have said. But halfway through their talks, the issue of artificial intelligence really started to take a big presence. It really became a big point. And the other point that the studios did not want to give in on was revenue sharing. But there was a moment that Fran Drescher, the SAG president, came. It was in late June, and she had a video from the studios negotiating sort of headquarters saying that they were making great progress. That moment was huge. It was pivotal. Within a few days, a letter was written by A-list actors saying that this is not the year to meet in the middle. No, you know, unless they had a breakthrough transformative deal, they were more willing to strike. So that put the SAG leadership sort of behind the eight ball. They had to come out with a huge deal, and the studios just were not willing to move on certain things, including the revenue share.
And Meg, it seems like this isn't, I think, a usual labor strike where it's, you know, hey, we think it's time to get paid a little more. We want more benefits. You know, that's all there. But there's also, for both writers and actors, this transformational moment, it seems like. You mentioned artificial intelligence. How do we deal with who gets money when things are streamed, streamed originally, streamed later? Can you talk about some of those basic structural things that make this kind of a different moment for studios, actors, and writers?
Exactly. If this was a conversation about higher wages, higher minimum rates, the issues would have been solved a long time ago. But the issue that has been roiling the creative community here in Los Angeles, New York, and beyond is that the streaming model is fundamentally different. It used to be that a television writer and a television actor would work almost 9 months of a year on a TV series. There'd be 22 episodes produced. There was plenty of, you know, fees for the writers to get paid for their scripts and also for the actors per their appearances. But what happened with the streaming model is these streamers, Netflix led the way, decided that, hey, we don't need 22 episodes. 8 or 9, maybe even 7 episodes for a season would be fine. And from there, it really changed how the earning power of these creatives, the writers, the directors, and the actors were paid. And what they found was that they were earning a lot less than they had in the previous model prior to streaming. And that's what's changed the complexion of these talks. And that is also why it has become so, both sides are so entrenched, because that we are looking at profound changes to the industry. And also, people are not making a living wage at the mid-levels and lower levels of the business. And that's concerning, too.
And Meg, people might think actor, and they might think, you know, the big name actors who are bringing home lots of money. Can you talk about, you know, all those actors who aren't, you know, the Tom Cruises and the writers, for that matter, who are kind of living more hand-to-mouth?
Precisely. I mean, of course, the Tom Cruises, the Meryl Streeps, you know, the Matt Damons, they're making, you know, humongous salaries or fees. They're doing incredibly well. But that is just a small fraction of the industry. Most actors, they you know, sort of try to string job by job by job so they can make a living, so that they can actually earn enough so that they can qualify for the Guild pension and health plans. And I would say easily, you know, 70% of the actors are not even mid-range people. They're actually people just scraping by. In fact, one of our other reporters talked to a picketer for a hotel strike that's going on. And this person worked at the front desk, but they also were participating in the SAG strike because they were struggling to make it as an actor.
Is there any sense of how long these two strikes, the writers and the actors, could go on?
Well, this is a huge and open question, and it looks like both sides are really dug in. For the studios, and Walt Disney Company CEO Bob Iger was very clear about this last week, that this comes at the worst possible time. These studios haven't recovered from the COVID pandemic. Movie theater attendance is way down. And just other parts of their business have really been under strain because they've been spending billions of dollars to try to ramp up their own streaming services to take on Netflix. So they have huge losses. So now that everything is shut down, almost everything, there are still some independent productions that are still going forward. But now that most production is shut down, it's really a stalemate. And I think both sides, unfortunately, will have to feel some pain before they will go back to the table. We've heard estimates that they might not even start talking till September, which would mean there would be no more, you know, widespread production for the rest of the year. So this is really a horrible moment in Los Angeles, because when the actors go out, everything shuts down. Caterers, you know, taxi drivers, Uber drivers, you know, hair and makeup, publicists, all these people just see their work dry up too. So the ripple effect is going to be enormous.
And briefly, Meg, as we wrap up, when will consumers of TV and movies start to see the impact of these strikes?
That's a really good question, because so many of these streaming services, so many of these companies have huge libraries and a pipeline of programming that was already in the works. So it might be a while before you start noticing, you know, fewer news shows on Netflix or HBO Max. But for the broadcast networks, the ABC, NBC, CBS, they have already felt it. You know, the late night comedians are off the air. They won't have new scripted shows for the fall. And I think it will really be acute for those broadcast networks, because they're so reliant on fresh programming.
We'll leave it there. Meg, thanks for bringing us up to date.
Thank you very much. You guys be well.
That was Meg James, senior entertainment industry writer for the Los Angeles Times. I talked to her about the latest on the major film and TV actors and writers strikes. Coming up, we'll take another look at the story with an expert on labor from UW-Madison, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this strike? What's behind it? What do you think about it? And what do you think about these big changes in the entertainment industry, the rise of streaming, and maybe using AI language learning programs in the creation of the stuff that we watch? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the actors and writers strikes in the entertainment industry. Michael Childers joins us now. He's a professor in the UW-Madison School for Workers and Department of Labor Education. You could join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to this big strike, the two big strikes in the entertainment industry, 800-642-1234. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
It's always a pleasure to be on with you, Rob.
Last talked to you about 2 months-ish ago when the Writers Union started its strike. Is there a connection between that one and now the actors going on strike?
Yeah, it's definitely warming up to be a hot labor summer. I think definitely the writers, as we talked back then, the writers were sort of the first to go in this triad of contracts that the producers had to negotiate. And yeah, since that strike was called and the writers have been on the picket line, they actually haven't even had any meaningful negotiations with the producers.
I want to go back to, we heard some of the Fran Drescher speech. We played a clip at the top of the segment. Here she is putting this actor strike now in the greater context of labor struggles in general.
What happens here is important, because what's happening to us is happening across all fields of labor by means of when employers make Wall Street and greed their priority, and they forget about the essential contributors that make the machine run. We have a problem.
I think it's easy to think about the entertainment industry as, you know, something unique, something different. Here, she's connecting this labor action to workers in all fields in some ways. What do you think of that, Michael?
I think she's exactly right. And in a way, she's basically, they're far and away on the tail end of the impact of the financialization of our economy. I think most working people in Wisconsin and across the country would say, yeah, this is the stuff that's been happening across the manufacturing sector. I mean, this is a major reason why UPS went on strike back the last time they did in 97. And we may be talking about them being on strike 10 days from now, is the kind of casualization of work, the erosion of benefits and pay that workers have experienced across many industries in the United States. And it's come to Hollywood now. The writers have been facing it literally since their last contract. And now the actors are trying essentially to renegotiate before they start to bear the brunt of these kind of seismic changes to their industry.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Tony is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Tony, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think SAG is really going to be a harbinger of what is to come in the entertainment industry, and I think everything's on the table right now, including professional sports. And if the public is more interested in watching YouTubers free, they're not going to pay to go to the theater. And I think with the advent of AI, the industry is realizing that there will be a point where you won't know if it's real or it's animated. And I think the days of blockbuster movies are fewer and far between, and they're too expensive to produce.
Tony, thanks a lot for the call. Tony hitting on a lot of parts of this story here. Michael, let's start, first of all, with something that actors and writers are concerned about, the so-called AI programs that might be filling in at least for parts of the jobs done by writers, maybe actors, and as Tony was hinting at, I think in other lines of work.
Sure. And again, back when we talked about the writers, this was I think I said this is the first major national contract where AI is a major point of negotiation. Everyone that's played at all on the internet, familiar at all with some of these, you know, large text-based content AI tools like ChatGPT, for example, or Google's Bard, could see how, with given a prompt, these machines can essentially start churning out text. And for the writers, that became a key sticking point because they want to prohibit its use in certain contexts and put great limits on it in others. And it's the same for actors. And frankly, we haven't talked about it, but for musicians as well, for artists in general, because there are AI bots that can generate all of these things, music, art, and text, and use images and likenesses to, yeah, in essence, create a bunch of computerized extras, which would kind of, to the point that your reporter from the LA Times was making, you know, most of the people that are affected here are not making tons of money. They're on the low end, and that's really who SAG is trying to stand up for in this contract.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tony. Another big part of the story, Michael, is streaming. You know, it's a different model for distribution of movies and TV shows. We just heard from Meg that's shaking things up. And part of the story there, too, is, you know, if I'm an actor or writer and I want to know how well my show is doing, how many people have watched it on Netflix, I don't know. And they're not going to tell you, right?
Yeah, that's a big part of the issue, no question. I mean, they're facing, yeah, maybe a double or a triple disruption in that sense to this industry. And yes, the old model was immediately, when you think of television, especially network television, everyone's familiar with reruns, syndication of shows, et cetera, which results in what they're calling these residuals, which is payments to these actors and writers once their show has already been produced and continues to be viewed and used by, you know, to be broadcast. And again, you're mentioning it, both the idea that we don't have a model right now that's been negotiated that in any way rewards the actors or the writers based on the actual numbers of views. But in addition to that, it's unclear when or if any of these programs will be reshown. In essence, they're like property of Netflix, for example. And there's no telling. If Netflix just pulls them, then, you know, there won't be any residuals. So there's no question. And that's, I think, the first quote that you played from President Drescher from SAG. That's what she's alluding to when she talks about the fundamental, you can't have incremental changes. when you've had a fundamental shift to the industry. We need a new model that more accurately compensates us as we've been compensated in the past.
Now, from studios, especially the ones that, you know, put movies out that people go to see or theoretically go to see in theaters, they're saying, hey, wait a minute, we're being disrupted too by COVID, by streaming. A lot of them have sunk money into trying to have their own streaming services, haven't figured out how to make money doing that, at least not that effectively, given the investments. How much wiggle room do the businesses themselves have?
Well, again, this is kind of back to the financialization point. Just real quick before we go there, though, just to think about it, again, these companies are not like the old school studios anymore. Some of the major players in the media market now are these streaming services, Amazon, Apple, where they don't have kind of this long-term relationship with SAG-AFTRA that the other directors do. It was interesting because Fran actually alluded to this when she talked about why they gave them that extension at the end of June, because in her mind, she was thinking, okay, they're kind of working it out amongst themselves. She was hopeful that it's the old school studios. They're telling the people like Apple, Netflix, hey, fellas, the jig's up. We're kind of going to have to get back to a model where there's a proportionate financial reward for these folks based off of the way it used to work with network. And that didn't happen, right?
Talking to Michael Childers, professor in the UW-Madison School for Workers and Department of Labor Education, looking at the big strikes in the entertainment industry. The main Screen Actors Guild and writers have been on strike, the writers, for a couple months now. Michael, what are you watching for to see if the strikers are successful in getting their demands met, if the studios can live without actors and writers for a long time? What determines a success for either side in a situation like this?
Well, they both have their bargaining goals, and your earlier guest did allude to this. I mean, ironically, it's the streaming services that are best positioned in terms of having more content ready to go in the can, so to speak, versus the broadcast networks where they're, you know, basically this fall, if you don't like reality TV or game shows or watch live sports, there's not going to be much on new for you to view. So there is going to be an immediate, they're already, you know, talking about how they are rescheduling production, both on, you know, television shows and on, you know, the motion pictures. So, you know, in a real sense, had the actors settled, the writers would have been in really desperate straits. The fact that they're both out now for the first time in six decades gives them both more strength.
How much does public opinion matter in a dispute like this, in a high-profile industry?
I think it matters in every case, right? And I know we have, you haven't talked about it much, but there's, you know, again, there's major labor actions occurring across the country, and one that will definitely impact us all may happen within 10 days, which in terms of we've all seen when supply chains get gummed mm-hmm. up. And that's very, you know, possible if we end up seeing a strike between the Teamsters and UPS, if they're not able to hammer out an agreement. I think, you know, Fran Drescher has done a great job of trying to explain in terms that most people can understand what it is that the actors are trying to achieve in this bargain. And I think she's done a very good job of that.
Time for one more quick call with Gail in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. I'm really concerned that I'm thinking that this is premeditated on the side of the people who don't want to be continuing the union, because back in 2012, I was reading online, the SAG merged their guild or whatever with another mm-hmm. television and whatever group for their union, for the pensions and everything, I guess. And so I'm wondering if it's just all about trying to bust that, like so many unions have been busted. And
gotcha. Gail, we don't have a lot of time. Michael, is this an effort ultimately, you think, on behalf of the studios to bust this big union?
Well, I think that merger actually did end up making them stronger. And I might quibble a minute with a point that Meg made earlier, which was, I think the solidarity you've seen both across SAG-AFTRA and within all of the entertainment industries. And that actually includes like the stagehands union, IATSE. The Teamsters do a lot of work in the entertainment industry as well. And it's been pretty unequivocal in terms of support, because they all understand that they come up together and they'll go down together. I guess the thing I would also note is just, look, if the actors aren't able to achieve their bargaining goals, then they're going to see the same sorts of erosion that other workers have seen in our economy over the last several decades. So,
and we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Michael Childers, professor in the UW-Madison School for Workers and Department of Labor Education there. We talked with him, and we heard from LA Times writer Meg James about the issues at the root of the actors and writers' strikes in the entertainment industry. Tomorrow in the morning show, is Wisconsin Parmesan cheese more authentic than Italian Parmesan? And what does it mean to be authentic? That's tomorrow morning at 7 on the Ideas Network. Do you want to rock and roll all night, or do you want to have your partying done by early evening? Americans may be having their fun earlier and earlier these days, according to a piece in the Wall Street Journal. They checked in on restaurants, theaters, and music venues in cities known for their late-night action, like New York, New Orleans, Los Angeles. Plus, they checked out online restaurant reservation data around the country. Their findings, when we go out to dinner, we're going earlier than we used to. Some restaurants that stayed open until 11 or midnight are starting dinner service earlier, closing up by 9. And Broadway plays, some of them, are starting earlier. A music promoter in New Orleans says he used to schedule headline acts to start as late as 1 a.m., now he's more likely to book shows starting at 6 p.m., wrapping up by 11. I mostly approve of the trend. By nature, I'm a night owl, but I don't necessarily like doing stuff until super late. Back in the day, my band used to close bars at 2 or 2:30 in the morning. Then you got to load out, home by 3:30 or 4. I did it, but I was always too old for that. Rock and roll all evening, party every now and then. This is Central Time.
You're listening to The Ideas Network from Wisconsin Public Radio.